Kia ora tātou, nō mai, haere mai, and welcome to another Asia Insight from the Asia New Zealand Foundation in Wellington. I'm Graham Acton. India's External Affairs Minister, Dr. Subramaniam Jaishankar, is one of India's leading statesmen. An influential member of the BJP-led government, he's also a career diplomat who served as Foreign Secretary and also as India's ambassador to the US, China and Singapore. His PhD was on nuclear diplomacy, and he's also worked for a time for Tata Sons, India's largest company. He was in New Zealand recently for discussions with the government as well as a few public events in Auckland and Wellington. This was the first visit by India's External Affairs Minister since 2001. Along with my colleague Suze Jessop, Head of Research and Engagement at the Asia New Zealand Foundation, I grabbed a few minutes of the Minister's time for his thoughts on where India is headed in 2022 and how this country could develop its relationships with his. Minister, a very warm welcome to Aotearoa New Zealand.
Thank you.
It's exciting to have you here, and we're honoured to have you join us for this discussion. You're the first Indian Minister of External Affairs to visit our shores for many years. Mm-hmm. And as an experienced foreign minister of a major power, when you think of New Zealand, what comes to mind in the foreign policy space?
Well, a lot of things, really. I think some of it is history, tradition, you know, shared connections, which is articulated, among other things, in the Commonwealth. Some of it is really today the Indo-Pacific, the fact that we are at two corners or two sides, really, of a very vast space, but a very interconnected space amongst us. Also, perhaps, to me, the importance of tradition, of cultures, of diversity, attributes that I think we share, of cricket, certainly. I guess a lot of it depends on the context, but mostly good things, by bonds which really can be the basis of a very strong relationship.
Wonderful, thank you, Minister. Building on from this, I wonder if you could share with us the purpose of your visit and what you hope to achieve whilst you're in New Zealand. And looking forward, where do you see specific potential in the New Zealand-India relationship?
Well, you know, foreign ministers' visits have a utility of their own. And I think the purpose, in a way, could be being here, you know, meeting your counterpart, meeting other colleagues, meeting stakeholders in the relationship. And I would say trying to see how do we take this relationship to a higher level, which I think the times today require us to do. So some of it is therefore been an exercise in stock taking, some of it an exercise in strategizing. I've been saying both in my meetings and in public that the two of us need to play to our strengths, see what it is we're good at, which can be of interest or utility to the other side. And I believe there are a lot of possibilities here. Meeting other officials, you know, meeting, of course, my counterpart minister, meeting people in the business world, as I did yesterday and today. These are all quite helpful. And I certainly think that if we were to focus today on stronger business collaboration, seeing how we develop the digital domain to mutual advantage, looking to see whether we can build education as a stronger connect between us, looking at, you know, the security, stability, prosperity of the Indo-Pacific as a shared goal. I think there are a lot of ideas that I would be leaving with.
Is there in the business space, is there specific kinds of industries or businesses that you are thinking of when you say that?
Well, you know, having been briefly in business, I think the best people to judge a business opportunity are business. And I would say it's our job as a government to encourage them to lay out the possibilities, if there are any impediments, regulatory or otherwise, to address them. My sense is that on both sides, there could be a heightened awareness about how do we capture the changes which are taking place in both societies. Because those changes really offer new possibilities. I mentioned, for example, digital. It's today, it could be fintech, it could be cybersecurity, or if you were to look at the climate action side, we speak about climate as a public movement almost, but it has to be underpinned by a business. You know, it'll work if there are enough businesses devoted really to making it work.
Is that something that's developing in India in a meaningful way? Green business?
Absolutely. You know, we are today among the largest countries, the countries with the largest renewable program. But there are a range of other associated activities. I mean, if you look even in terms of policy initiatives and getting people to actually understand and sometimes reimagine what the challenges are. We've been involved with the International Solar Alliance from the start. It was an idea which Prime Minister Modi felt very strongly about at Paris. Then he pushed the Coalition for Disaster Resilient Infrastructure at Glasgow and COP26. He pushed strongly for an initiative which would address the concerns of the island states. So there was an infrastructure for resilient island states called IRIS. Now, these are, in a sense, broad, you could say almost labels, which capture a set of activities, collaborations, which finally end up as projects on the ground, and also exchange of best practices. And I think in this, what India and New Zealand can bring to bear together would be much more than what we would do if we were to do it by ourselves.
Just, can I ask you an international relations question broadly? Yes. From a New Zealand perspective, the world looks more uncertain now than it has for a while. As a traditionally non-aligned country with long borders and complex neighbours, how do things look from an Indian perspective? What are India's top foreign policy priorities at the moment?
Well, I'm afraid the world looks just as uncertain and volatile to us as it does to you. And neither size nor location honestly provide different comfort today. And there are reasons for it. Part of it is that over the last maybe decade and a half, the fundamentals of an order which came about after the Second World War are changing. Now, change in itself is not a bad thing. In fact, I would argue in this case it's a good thing, because countries that became independent after the 1940s, beginning with India, we are now coming into play. There are new centers of production and consumption in the world. So there's a diversification, a democratization, you can say, of the world. But when there are big changes can carry with them risks, instability, sometimes of overreach, of miscalculation. And so it's very important that the transition which the world is going through to create the next order, if you would, that takes place in as risk-free a possible manner as possible. And these are really long-term trends which were evident even before the COVID. But if you look at the last few years, I think COVID has driven home an awareness that there are some inbuilt shortcomings in our in the model of the world we've been all working with. We, I think, perhaps invested in globalization without fully understanding that it can have a downside, that disruptions can create huge vulnerabilities and anxieties. And we saw that during COVID, that, you know, disruptions actually exposed many countries to big worries there. Then we've had conflicts, and, you know, we are today witnessing how a conflict in Europe can affect every corner of the world and affect it not just in terms of inconvenience, but affect it in terms of actually the fundamentals of the day-to-day living of their citizens, you know. And many countries which were on the edge are today worried that the problems coming out of the Ukraine conflict could really push them over. And, you know, we spoke about climate. I think climate events are going to be part of our life. And these are not, the concerns of well-wishing NGOs. I mean, these are governance emergencies and sometimes catastrophes which we will have to address. And we've already seen that in different ways, in different geographies. So I think there is honestly a lot to worry about and a lot to worry about that's man-made and that is the outcome of choices and policies, but which to my mind can be mitigated and de-risked through collective efforts. And part of the reason I'm here is also to see if there's a meeting of minds in New Zealand and whether each of us in our own way, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a big country, small country, where are we located, what can we do? I think everybody can make a difference and together perhaps more of a difference.
Thinking about those complexities of climate and conflict, COVID, and all of the other issues that India is pursuing, do you have a sense of where India has the most agency to affect change on the international stage in terms of where you're really concentrating your effort right now?
We are roughly about 1/6 the population of the world. No, I say that for a very sober reason. If we succeed, if we do better, that's like 16% of the world's problems being addressed at one go. And I would argue that if we can demonstrate, how to do the difficult things on scale, we're not just doing the 1/6 of the world's challenges, but we're also, in a sense, an example for others. When people look at us and say, okay, if they can do it, we can do it too. So I look at something like digitization. We've had this huge record in the last 2-3 years, massive record of digital delivery of socio-economic programs. So it could be a safety net, a food and financial safety net. It could be building toilets and now houses. It could be connecting water and electricity to homes. It could be about getting, kids to school and keeping them there and monitoring that they are doing this. So there is so much out there that I think we could do for ourselves and thereby for the world, and also, share and inspire others. So that's one part of it. And I think we will be central to the achievement, to the success of Agenda 2030. The second, again, I come back to climate. And, I think if I'm a bit obsessive about it, rightly so.
For good reason.
Yes. And my sense is that whether it is the energy mix that we change to, whether it's the energy efficiencies and energy saving that we introduce into our economy, whether it's most of all, and my prime minister keeps saying this, it's a lot of it is about lifestyle, that how do we adapt to a much more energy-friendly lifestyle? How do we organize our life and livelihood around a different consumption of energy? So, again, I think we would make a big difference. And some of it is also, in a sense, what you call rebalancing in the world, which is countries who had contributions but who went out of play for, you know, in our case, because of colonialism, that in the post-colonial era, bringing our culture, our civilization, our traditions, our heritage back into play, making it part of a sort of a global pool, if you would, and I think that's something which should be of interest to people in New Zealand as well.
Absolutely. In fact, that was what I was struck with in India, the number of people biking, the number of people practicing yoga every morning. I mean, there are a lot of elements to Indian society and Indian philosophy and approach to life that are actually already, there are answers there. Many of the issues we're discussing carry significant implications for future generations. Exactly as you note, India has phenomenal young people power. How are India's next generation shaping India's foreign policy agenda, and what are their expectations?
I think one impact we will make increasingly on the world is that of talent and skills, because the world is moving towards a greater knowledge-centered economy. Increasingly, if you look at almost everything we do, there's some form of, you can say, intelligence embedded in it. And at the end of the day, whatever is embedded comes out of some human thought. Now, look at the economy of the world and look at the demography of the world. You can see they are clearly not aligned. And obviously, there are there are reasons for this. So if India could improve, enhance really its human resources and bring it into play as a global economic factor, I think that's a big difference we could make. And if I were to now take a bilateral slice of it, I understood from my discussions with my counterpart that New Zealand has a shortage of skills in certain areas. Now, this is beginning to happen. You know, governments are approaching us and saying, okay, can we conclude a mobility agreement where there's an orderly, protected, mutually beneficial way of ensuring the talent and skills move between us. Now, sometimes countries do that unilaterally. I mean, if you look at the Americans, the whole H-1B visa or, you know, J visas, these were meant, O visas were meant for America to get this talent. But I would say not everybody has that capacity. Sometimes it's good for countries to arrive at an understanding. We've done that in recent years with some of the countries of the European Union, also with Japan. I suggested it's something which might be useful even for New Zealand to contemplate. I mean, obviously, it's, you know, it's for the government here to decide what, where the shortages are and where you need people. But the young in India, look, the young in India will change India, because honestly, they are a far more confident generation. So much ability to think through solutions today, to innovate, to take that into the ground. There's an energy out there you can actually almost feel. If we can unleash that into a world arena, I think the world will be the better for it.
India will assume the presidency of the G20 for 1 year from December. G20 accounts for 85% of global GDP, 75% of international trade, and two-thirds of the world population. What are India's priorities for its term as president?
We still have about close to 2 months to go, a month and a half to go before we take over the presidency. And we have a summit to hold in Indonesia before that. I think at the moment, the first immediate concern is for the G20 to be the G20. It was meant as a forum to discuss major economic and financial issues facing the world. And it, in my view, it should stay focused on those sets of challenges, even though I accept that there may be many other pressing concerns. But the G20 should stay focused on the G20 mission. Now, what is the mission right now? I would say for environment, certainly environment in the broadest sense of the term, how do we ensure that climate action, climate justice advance? And these need to be backed up with some credible, financial resources effort underpinning it. I think there's some discussion on that how do you ensure green lending on a major scale? Secondly, today a lot of countries of the global south feel that their interests and their concerns and their worries have not been adequately recognized and factored in. It could be debt, it could be energy, it could be food. We need to get that on the table. Perhaps beyond that, we need to also look to see how the global financial architecture is re-engineered in a much more sustainable and equitable way. So there's plenty for the G20 to do. We will, of course, take stock because you kind of focus your mind. You keep your preparations ready. It'll be really when the baton is handed over that you articulate it then with a degree of sharpness. But I think it'll be broadly in this space.
One more question, yeah?
Yeah, if time allows.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this can be a very quick comment. India brings its own perspective to the Quad grouping, one that's really seemed to emphasise the cooperation you've been talking about to us today over the sort of military posturing that sometimes we hear from such groupings. Is the Quad meeting India's needs, and how would you like to see the Quad evolve?
You know, to be fair, I think not just India, but every one of the Quad members bring their particular perspective. So that's only fair. You would accept the Quad has made enormous progress in the last 5 years. And it's done that because there is actually a common ground. There is a convergence in how the four countries are approaching the Quad. And we are looking at Quad really as a larger platform where the four of us, by pooling our efforts in a range of domains, are able to ensure a free and open Indo-Pacific. Now, the domains could be from education and health to, humanitarian assistance to technologies to connectivity to maritime security. So we really want a broad-based sort of platform, which becomes, in a way, a foundation for security and stability and prosperity in the Indo-Pacific. And my sense, quite honestly, is that we have, you might say, exceeded market expectations in this regard in the last few years. But obviously, we continue to want to intensify and develop the Quad.
Wonderful.
Minister, thanks very much. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be part of this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Asia Insight. Thanks for listening. Ka kite anō.